Good morning and welcome to Path to Liberty for July 24th, 2019. My name is Michael Bolden, broadcasting to you live from my home office and studio here in downtown Los Angeles for the 10th Amendment Center, where we broadcast every single Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, well, almost every single one, at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time through our channels over at YouTube, Facebook, Periscope, DLive, and twitch.tv. We also have archives and a really great podcast-only edition, so audio only if you prefer that, through iTunes, Spotify, and elsewhere. All the links, the previous episodes, show notes, and where you can follow the show are at 10thamendmentcenter.com/path-to-liberty, all spelled out. Now, today we're talking about federal enforcement. A lot of people believe that if there's a law on the books in Washington, D.C., and I put law in quotes, no matter how unconstitutional, wrong, or right, or anything, they just believe that if there's a law on the books, that the law needs to be enforced in full until it's overturned by the Supreme Court or repealed by Congress. Now, I'm sure this isn't a surprise for you, but on this part of the Constitution, or this view of the Constitution, a lot of people are totally wrong. Now, before getting into that, I don't want to gloss over something that might be pretty obvious to people who watch or listen to the show on a regular basis. You might be thinking to yourself, like, hey, did he just say welcome to Path to Liberty rather than good morning, Liberty? And the answer is absolutely yes. If you're new to the show, ignore this, or maybe listen if you want to. But after doing the show for a year, we started July 30th, 2018. We actually just did a name change, a rebranding from Good Morning Liberty to Path to Liberty. And there's some very good reasons behind that. Primarily, some other really good people are doing a daily show called Good Morning Liberty, and I think it's just a very good business decision to approach it in a different way. And then also, the idea that I had when I first started the show, just kind of as a trial run, was going to be morning news, like Good Morning America, talking about news from a liberty perspective. But I don't, as the show has progressed, and you guys have sent me ideas over at team@10thamendmentcenter.com, ideas on what you cover, day-to-day news is a very small part of what I do here on this show. And I really focus on kind of a three-piece thing, covering daily news from a liberty constitution perspective, the original meaning of various parts of the Constitution, and then strategies to liberty. It really kind of encompasses our work more broadly. I did a full audio-only podcast edition explaining what's going on, about 10 minutes. If you want to check it out, again, the link is 10thamendmentcenter.com/path-to-liberty. I also have the link in the show notes on YouTube if you're watching live. Otherwise, check that link again, 10thamendmentcenter.com/path-to-liberty. All links that you've used in the past will be redirected to the new ones going forward. Anyways, enough on that. I want to say hi to my friends out in the live chat, Justin Bayola, Heather Rossi, EHP Training, who reminds us all to smash the like. Thank you. Ward Lawrence, Tyler B., Joseph Standridge, Bob Brewer, good to see you. Hi from Tyler. And then Justin Morrison and Clay Davis on Facebook, Dan Reed, who notices the new video opening. I've actually used it once in a while, but it actually matches the name of the show. It's titled Path to Liberty. Brock Story, Shane Lackey, good to see you as well. Michael Bogus, Nappy, and many others. I apologize if, oh, Kenneth Sprenger, good to see you as well from White Plains, New York. Whether you're live or in the archives, please continue leaving some comments here. I really, really appreciate your feedback, whatever the platform. You can also send me ideas for shows you'd like me to cover in the future at team@10thamendmentcenter.com. Okay, enough blabbing. More blabbing then. Enough blabbing on these intro ideas. But let's check this out. So there are really, at least in my experience, there's really three ways that we hear people demand this type of full enforcement approach from the federal government, even though we know, and I've covered in various ways on different issues, there is no way that the federal government can do full enforcement on almost anything, especially if they're not getting help from states. They just don't have the manpower or the resources in almost any of these so-called federal agencies that exist. It's really a pipe dream. It's a fantasy. It's a theoretical, it's a rhetorical attack on other people, and it has no grounding in reality. It also has no grounding in the view of the founders. So the three ways that I hear about it, let's say you're having a discussion with someone about a constitutional issue, let's say Obamacare, for example, whatever the so-called federal law regulation, you go back and forth with this person over and over, and it's like whack-a-mole. You're telling them this is the view of this founder, and this is how they looked at this clause, and every time you say something, they change it a little bit until you've given them so much information, and you know that you're going to convince them. And you're going to back them into a corner, and there's no excuses, there's no reason they're going to get away with it. And their next response to you is going to be like, okay, well, maybe you're right. Maybe you've convinced me that that's the way it should be. But why don't you take it to the Supreme Court? Let's see what happens. And that's how they approach it. The second one, when they say, in the meantime, well, it's still law and it's got to be enforced. The second version is almost the same, but in this case, the person might agree with you right off the bat, or they might be making excuses for why their preferred president, not necessarily the current one, I guess we could say current or former, any of them, was enforcing something that they disagreed with, either on a policy perspective or a constitutional perspective. They basically just have the same end result. Really, they'll tell you, yeah, you know, I agree with you. Hopefully the Supreme Court will overturn it. In the meantime, work with me to elect Republicans, elect Democrats, elect this candidate, and we'll get it overturned next year or the year after. And that's their approach. Again, wait on the Supreme Court or a new election. And then the third version we get from people is basically we're told the Congress passes laws, president enforces them, and the Supreme Court determines which ones are constitutional or not. And the president doesn't get to pick and choose which laws he likes or doesn't like, and he has to enforce everything that's on the books. Again, even though there's no way they could ever do full enforcement, ever. There's not a chance. Now, all three of these, and I'm sure there's other versions of this as well, is that they are really taking a view of judicial supremacy. Oh, and I want to point out, I didn't pull up the link here. This was the episode that I did yesterday. It was late yesterday. I wanted to do it a little bit earlier, but I also had a laptop breakdown over the weekend. Doesn't necessarily run the show, but it helps me with some organization with my notes and running the chat and things like that. And so I just thought the timing was good. Anyway, so I did this episode yesterday, Path to Liberty, special update on our new show name. You can only find it in the audio version, but if you want to check that out, that'll give you a full overview of my back and forth, my thought process, the people that already have the name, goodmorningliberty.us. It actually seems to be a pretty good show. I hope you check it out, but if you want to see that as well. So going back to this federal enforcement and these three varying views, you know, take it to the Supreme Court. I don't agree with you, but if you think this way, go to the Supreme Court. The second one is, I agree with you, but, you know, the Supreme Court hasn't overturned it, and let's vote in some new bums to overturn this. And then the third one, the president doesn't get to pick and choose which ones he's enforced. They're all taking a position on that the Supreme Court is not the highest court, that it has supremacy over the Constitution, over the other branches. It's not a co-equal branch. And I did a full episode, actually probably two or three. One that I think is very prominent that I hope you'll check out if you haven't yet is titled The Marbury versus Madison Myth. I did it last week, Wednesday. This is the myth of 1803, the multiple myths that came from Chief Justice John Marshall, or the views of what he had to say. And a lot of people have interpreted this, or they run with the notion that because Marshall said he had an oath to the Constitution and that he had to give an opinion on the constitutionality of things, judicial review is what we would call it, that this means that the Supreme Court is the only ones who get to have an opinion on the constitutionality of something, and everybody else is just kind of playing along until things change. So the short version of what we're talking about here is that it really gets down to the oath of office. Everyone takes an oath to the Constitution. Their duty is to the Constitution. Their duty isn't to what everybody else wants it to be. For example, the version number two, where they say, you know, I agree with you, the president can't do anything about this. Actually, all the versions, they basically take the position that the president takes an oath to the laws of Congress, to the regulatory book, not to the Constitution. And this totally differs from how the founders actually view things. Now, that means in practice, and I covered this a little bit in this Marbury versus Madison myth episode that I'm pulling up on the screen here if you're watching, that means that each of the three branches and then everyone who takes an oath in the states, which is everyone elected to office as well or acting for government as well, when they take an oath of office, they're supposed to follow their oath to their best of their ability to their own understanding. It is not a we defer to 9 unelected or 5 unelected, unaccountable, politically connected lawyers that serve for a life term on a Supreme Court. That is not what it says in the Constitution, and there are no founders who ever said such a thing. None. Not even the centralizer, Hamilton, who I will get to in a bit. Now, that means Congress, if they pass something, the president might refuse to enforce it. Congress might refuse to fund something. They might try to repeal something. The Supreme Court may say, we think this is, and again, all Supreme Court, quote, rulings are actually opinions, even in their own papers. When they publish a ruling, it actually says opinion of the Supreme Court at the top. The Supreme Court may hold an opinion that it should be defunded, repealed, not enforced, because they see it as unconstitutional. But they don't have enforcement over the president, the actions of the president. The president could keep going on, and then it's up to the Congress to say, well, maybe we're going to impeach you over this. And this is how this co-equal branches fighting or balancing against each other rather than doing what has been done in modern times and turning it all over to the courts to have the final say on everything, what Thomas Jefferson told us would create an oligarchy, a very dangerous, dangerous one. So let's get over to some views on this a little bit further. I wrote this article middle of 2018, talking about federal enforcement. I've covered it a little bit in various episodes here, but I think a repeat and then in a little bit more detail will be helpful. So first of all, I want to point out that this idea that you're not supposed to obey or enforce acts that you believe to be unconstitutional is not something that's new. That's not something that they put in the text of the Constitution outside the oath. Now, if you take an oath to follow the Constitution and you personally believe that something is unconstitutional, it is immoral and totally wrong to enforce it. You should do nothing to effectuate that act, period. And that was basically what Marshall said in Marbury versus Madison. The role of the court, if the court views something as unconstitutional, is to do nothing to give it additional sanction. By saying that it fits within the Constitution, even if they believe it doesn't, is the wrong approach. You can't follow your oath and do that at the same time. Same with every officer of the government, every agent of the government. They all take an oath, they're not taking an oath to the opinions of the Supreme Court. They're not taking an oath to the regulatory state. They take an oath to the Constitution. If they know nothing about the Constitution in the first place, they shouldn't be there, and that's probably a separate problem. But this principle goes back a long ways, and it goes way further back than what I'm going to get into here. But I think a very prominent point where many people in the founding generation understood this started with the resistance to the Stamp Act. And here in this article, in response to the hated Stamp Act, Patrick Henry drafted a series of resolutions denouncing the act, declaring it illegal, unconstitutional, and unjust. Now, mind you, there were probably people at the time who said, oh, you can't do this in Virginia. This is your colonial assembly. This is up to Parliament. This is up to King George. You can't say it, but he said it anyways. Now, the House of Burgesses passed the resolutions, or most of them, in late May 1765. He went on to say that Virginians, this was an additional resolution that didn't actually get passed, but was circulated throughout the colonies and accepted as fact, whether it was passed by the House of Burgesses or not. He said that Virginians were not obliged to obey any tax laws not enacted by their assembly. He said, "Resolve, this Majesty's liege people, the inhabitants of this colony, are not bound to yield obedience to any law or ordinance whatsoever designed to impose any taxation whatsoever upon them, other than the laws and ordinance of this General Assembly aforesaid." He wasn't alone. John Hancock sent a letter to his agent in London, capturing the spirit of the time, saying the people of this country will never suffer themselves to be made slaves of by a submission to the damned act. He wasn't saying the people of this country minus the people who work in our local governments. He said all of them. We're not going to submit if we believe that it is wrong. Then if you move a little bit faster forward to the ratification debates in North Carolina, for example. Now this was, those two quotes were two of very, very many from the revolutionary time. We can look to Samuel Adams, James Otis, and many, many others who took the position that not only was the general public not bound to yield obedience to unconstitutional acts, this is the unwritten English Constitution, to illegal acts of the government, but they also utilized a refusal to cooperate. They pressured and they worked to get cooperation from sheriffs, maybe import agents, to not enforce various provisions of the Stamp Act. And that's what ended up bringing it down. So this was known to be a very successful approach and the right moral approach as well from the revolutionary times. And that translated forward, I believe, to the ratification debates over the Constitution. And in North Carolina, Archibald McLean, he was one of the leaders in the state against the Stamp Act. So this guy was well respected. And he was arguing back and forth with people about the Constitution. And people were concerned about the powers being delegated in that document. And this is how he put it. "If Congress should make a law beyond its powers and in the spirit of the Constitution, should we not say to Congress, you have no authority to make this law? There are limits beyond which you cannot go. You cannot exceed the power prescribed by the Constitution. You are amenable to us for your conduct. That act is unconstitutional. We will disregard it and punish you for the attempt." Disregard the law. And in Massachusetts, Theophilus Parsons said, "An act of usurpation, that is stealing power that has not been delegated to the government, it is not law." So if he didn't say it's not law as long as the courts tell us it's not law. It's not law because it is outside the Constitution. The Constitution itself is supreme. He said any man is justified in resistance to that act. I did mention also the great centralizer, Alexander Hamilton, in Federalist 33. He said that federal acts outside the Constitution would not be supreme. The only acts that are actually supreme under the so-called Supremacy Clause are those made in pursuance of the delegated powers of the Constitution. And he said, "These acts will be merely acts of usurpation and will deserve to be treated as such." They deserve to be treated as a theft of power, not as something you have to abide by until some court or a future Congress overturns it. Period. Now, going further, if you think of this kind of departmental approach, this various branches taking an oath and really meaning it, Thomas Jefferson, I think, was very prominent on this. And he actually took steps after he got into office to ensure that the effect of the Alien and Sedition Acts would not be felt on the public. And so he stopped enforcing it. He started pardoning people. And he explained this to his former friend John Adams. Maybe they remained friends till death in some way. But he wrote to Abigail in 1804, John Adams' wife, and he talked about his duty under his oath to the Constitution as president. He said, "Specific, I discharged every person under punishment or prosecution under the sedition law, because I considered and now consider that law to be a nullity. This is a sitting president. A president takes an oath to the Constitution, and what they should do is look at every act that they do from a constitutional lens, not from beating the opposing team, not from owning the libs or destroying the conservatives, not that perspective, from a perspective of the Constitution. Even if they got it wrong every single time, I would rather, I think everything in the world, not just the country, but the whole world would be a better place if they started at least looking at it in that direction. It would cause a very, very positive, I think, domino effect down the line. But Jefferson considered that law to be a nullity, even though it was on the books and the Supreme Court hadn't overturned it. He said it was a nullity as absolute and as palpable as if Congress had ordered us to fall down and worship a golden image. And that it was as much my duty to arrest its execution in every stage as it would have been to have rescued from the fiery furnace those who would have been cast into it for refusing to worship their image. In other words, it was his duty, because he took an oath to the Constitution, to not do things that he saw as violating the Constitution. He didn't wait for Congress to overturn it. He didn't wait for the Supreme Court to tell him it was okay. He took the position that it was that's his job. That's the only reason he's there. And if the people don't think that his approach to the Constitution is wrong, they don't vote him in. They replace him, or they pressure for impeachment because he's violating the laws on the books. So there is some gray area, and there's going to be competition between the branches and the states as well. He went along this same line, and it wasn't just a one-time letter to Abigail. He also wrote something similar to Spencer Roan, a friend of his, Judge Spencer Roan. He said, each department is truly independent of the others and has an equal right to decide for itself what is the meaning of the Constitution in the cases submitted to its action, and especially where it is to act ultimately and without appeal. Short version, again, in his letter to Spencer Roan, Jefferson said each department, each branch of government, it's their job. They're totally independent. None of them are subordinate to the other. None of them are greater than the other. And each, when they're taking action in their own sphere, it is their duty to act according to the Constitution, not to act according to what's written in the law book or in the case law, the precedent, or the regulations, whatever. They're just supposed to do what they believe is right. He wasn't alone, of course. Madison took the same approach. Here's the so-called father of the Constitution. Even late in life, 1834, he said the same thing. As the legislative, executive, and judicial departments of the U.S. are coordinate and each equally bound to support the Constitution, it follows that each must, in the exercise of its functions, be guided by the text of the Constitution according to its own interpretation of it. Here's the so-called father of the Constitution. That's how a lot of people see him, who's basically saying each branch, it is their job. It is their job. They are bound. They have duty bound. They are duty bound to support the Constitution. They're not duty bound to support the Constitution according to what John Marshall says the Constitution is. They are not duty bound to follow the Constitution according to what John Roberts tells us the Constitution is. They're duty bound to do it according to their own conscience. Now, they may be wrong, but they may be right. But the only right thing, the only duty they have is to do what they believe is best. And we have very, very little of that in politicians today, probably ever. Very little. And this is maybe a rare time in all history where you had prominent politicians, prominent government leaders. These are massive presidents that took this view. George Washington himself put this into practice. I'm not going to get into the whole issue. But in 1796, they tried to force him to submit documents that related to the Jay Treaty. And he said, well, you know, this is a good request. But he didn't have to comply with it. So Congress said that he was required under the Constitution, they took a view that under the Constitution, he was required to do what they were asking. He said, well, this is your request. This is your view. I'm not necessarily going to comply with it. Washington took the same position. And the short version, this is how I put it in the article. Washington didn't wait for the courts to tell him what he could or could not do. He simply made his own determination of constitutionality and acted on it. And again, there are very, very few people in Washington, D.C. today and probably ever that have taken this view, at least in modern times. They all want to defer to somebody else. And I think part of this is because they're ignorant. They're totally dumb when it comes to what the founders had to say. They don't know anything about it. But on the other hand, I think there's something nefarious. They're all bad guys, basically. There are very few actually good human beings that are elected politicians in Washington, D.C. And they like passing the buck. It is very easy. It's very, very easy for someone in Congress to say, well, you know, I wasn't here when that Congress passed this, and a different president signed it into law. It was challenged in the Supreme Court. You know, it's constitutional. I mean, you may not like it, but that's how it is. It's very easy for a president to say, you know, I'm pro-gun rights, but continue to enforce all these unconstitutional gun laws on the books since 1934 and beyond, because the Supreme Court hasn't turned it over. This is an excuse. This is passing the buck. This is not taking responsibility. This is not actually even following. If you take an oath to support and defend the Constitution and you view something as unconstitutional, you should just, and you continue to enforce it. I think personally, I might be over the top, but maybe you should be impeached for that. I don't know. If you're talking about impeachment, which I know a lot of people are, but very few people talk about it in regards to constitutional actions or carrying out things that never should have been put into effect. Anyways, looking over at the live chat, a lot of interesting stuff. Frank I points out that they all know this. Federal gun laws all are under the Commerce Clause that they twist into it. Yeah, they use legalese and deception. I think this whole deferring to the Supreme Court is deception. It turns the country into an oligarchy of unelected people. That's what Jefferson warned us of. Jefferson was, surprise, surprise, right. Ward Lawrence says, let the Constitution rule, not the majority of the people. Sure, absolutely. That's how it should be. Shane Lackey, if it violates my constitution, I cannot be compelled to do it against my will. Now, they may have more guns than you, and I think we have to look at some practical realities of this, but certainly this is the right approach. You have to start looking at it in the way that you believe, not just deferring to some politicians. This is putting either the branch of government or the people themselves to the power of a king, basically. And this is not what the founders created. Hi, over to One False Step over on DLive. Awesome. I love DLive. Good morning, TAC. Thank you for being here. Justin Bayola, you're absolutely correct. This is basically the same thing I keep saying over and over and over. This is a deferral of responsibility in knowingly screwing us. That's a great. And Shane, yeah, you're right. You don't decide what my oath means. That's, you know, what it means to you is how they should be approaching it. But you don't ever really hear anybody referring to that. When they pass larger budgets, they make political statements. They talk about defeating Democrats. They talk about defeating Republicans. They talk about incumbents. Who's the most electable? This policy versus that policy. And almost never does anyone say, my oath of office requires me to participate or not participate in this particular federal act that's been on the books for 60, 70 years. I think it's been wrong all the time. You elected me to reduce the size of government. You elected me to drain the swamp, for example. And this is how I do it, because I will do everything in my sphere to make sure that these things are not put into effect. You may not always win, and you may run into a lot of problems, but that's what good people do. They do what's right, no matter how difficult it may be. Anyways, I hope you guys found this interesting and educational, fun to watch. I'm very grateful for you spending some time with me today. I really, really appreciate it. I hope you guys like the new show name. We're Path to Liberty going forward, talking about, I think, three important things. What the founders meant by various phrases in the Constitution, how they told us we were supposed to read the document, how both Democrats and Republicans today basically treat it like toilet paper? And then what do we need to do about it? And that's basically what I looked through the last 6 months of episodes of the show, and it's basically a third, a third, a third of these various things, and we're covering it all into one big package, I guess, as a path to achieving liberty in today's world. Again, thank you guys so much for joining me. If you want to follow along with the show links, the archives are at 10thamendmentcenter.com/path to liberty, all spelled out. 10thamendmentcenter.com/path to liberty. Please continue to leave comments, whether live or in the archive. Smash the like button, subscribe, hit the bell. I'm very grateful for all the reviews that have been coming in, all the 5-star reviews, everything over on iTunes. That's really incredible to me. Thank you so much to all of you. And if you want to support us financially, it's 10thamendmentcenter.com/members. $2 a month goes a long, long way here at the TAC. Thanks again for watching. I hope you have an awesome hump day Wednesday. We'll see you again on Friday at 9:30 a.m. for another episode of Path to Liberty. Thanks again. Have a great day.